tonight, huh? Old Bill? Come on, you.
Hey everybody, you're listening to the Drunken UX Podcast. This is episode number 36, 1 year since GDPR launched, and I am your host, Michael Feenan.
I'm your co-host, Aaron Hill. Welcome.
I've been thinking about this, Aaron, and we've talked about it a lot, and I think the trick is I need to stop introducing myself as the host. I am also the co-host. I am one of your co-hosts, Michael Feenan. That way, it levels that playing field, right? We're not host and co-host.
It's like that episode of The Office when you have Jim and Michael, and they're both managers, and like Michael handles the big picture ideas, and Jim handles the day to day stuff.
If you're listening this week, you should thank our sponsors over at NewCloud. You can run by their website at newcloud.com/drunkenUX. That will let them know that you heard about them from us and make that all be worthwhile, and we would appreciate it. But they do good stuff, maps and things. Oops. And such.
This is a good drink. Be sure to connect with us on Twitter and Facebook.com/DrunkenUX, and also on Instagrams, DrunkenUX Podcast, and DrunkenUX.com/Slack to come sign up and chat with us in Slack. You can ask us questions.
If you're following us on Instagram, I'm actually recording this episode on the microphone that I shared on there this week. I got my holy grail microphone finally, which was a Shure SM7B.
You chose wisely.
I have wanted one for a long time. It just randomly came up for sale locally from a fella, and I had to snatch it up. So we'll see how this sounds. Hopefully everybody enjoys it. If it sounds like garbage when I get it out of the mix, then I guess you'll just have to suffer me for an episode until I switch back. But I like it. So I'm departing a little bit from my normal drink this evening. I like bourbon, but I'm picky. I'm still like, you know, finding the bourbons I like. And I don't like Jack Daniels. I don't like Jack Daniels.
Respect.
But I have a bottle of Gentleman Jack. Because it came highly recommended to me, and I must say, it is quite excellent. It's not super like interesting necessarily. Like what does the band here say? It says it is double mellowed, and I feel like that is probably a relatively accurate way of describing this. Like, it's just sort of kick back, relax. You know, it's not super fancy, it's not super crazy, but you can definitely enjoy a glass.
They play Grateful Dead in the distillery while it was distilling.
I feel like that probably is not part of their culture, but sure. What? Yes, drink. You have a drink. What do you?
I have. It's an experiment, and it's actually not bad. I took some 1800 tequila, that coconut flavored, and I mixed it with some Bailey's. And I know that sounds like a weird drink combination, but it's actually not bad.
Did it curdle when you mixed it together?
It didn't, surprisingly. The coconut flavor in this 1800 is pretty strong. So it, you know, coconut has kind of like, it has the same kind of like shape sort of as like vanilla. Like it's like big open flavor, and the, it went well with the Irish cream. So.
Isn't that not bad. What a cement mixer is? Isn't a cement mixer tequila and Irish cream?
Is it? I thought that curdled, though.
Yeah, that's why I was asking. Maybe it's vodka. I don't know.
Oh. No, this didn't curdle. I mean, it's there's no like particulate matter in it at all.
Fair enough. Hey, if you like it, that's all that really matters.
Yeah. I would drink it again.
You were telling me earlier today about this chat. I say chat software, quote unquote. It's not, but
okay. So it circled, it went through the Twitters, and then someone on my work Slack posted it, and I was like, oh, I know that guy. So it's this guy, Kevin, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name, but he actually worked on my diaper based project at Ruby by the Bay last month, and he's a very cool dude, very good developer. And he made this thing, and it's a CSS only, well, HTML and CSS only chat tool. It's like bi-directional communication using just CSS. And it uses stuff that we kind of talked about before with the background image, kind of hacking its way, like smuggling data, exfiltrating it through background image. And you have here in the show notes, Ian Malcolm, and on the GitHub repo, he actually has that exact Ian Malcolm GIF.
Yeah, I made the joke earlier when we were talking about it, and then I went and looked at his readme, and I'm like, oh, he already beat me to that joke. Your scientists were so preoccupied with whether or not they could, they never stopped to think if they should.
Yeah.
Because I've made this argument before with some of this stuff that's, you know, it's sort of the proof of concept CSS sort of things. Like, the one thing I always remember is the guy that made Homer Simpson in only CSS.
Okay.
And, like, it looked good. It looked correct. But it was, you know, this huge thing of, like, divs and crazy CSS. It's like, you would never make an image that way. That is not a thing you would do.
Right, right.
And I used to always think about it in those terms. And I've kind of, as I've gotten older and more mature about it, it's become one of those things that I realize that it's an exercise. It's not about the result. It's about how you got there and the practice it takes to do that.
Do you know this isn't in our show notes, but it's kind of related. Do you know the story about the inverse square calculation they did in the Quake game? Do you remember that?
Man, I haven't had a math class since college.
Okay, so like if you're calculating distance, right? You have to do some square root calculations to calculate distance. But I want to say it was John Carmack, but might have been one of the other devs, but one of the devs on the Quake team figured out that you could approximate a square root by using the bit shift operator. And so the bit shift operator is an x86 instruction, so it's super fast, and it's close enough at an approximation that it gets you a good answer. So it allowed really complicated distance calculations to be done in a lot of different places very quickly, which made the game awesome. I mean, a lot of things made the game awesome, but that added to the awesomeness.
Yeah.
So, but I mean, I'm sure that started as like, oh, check this out. Look, if you do this, you can basically do the distance calculation. That's weird. Yeah.
The thing that just came up the other day that this made me think of and this application of these ideas is so this guy Rich Harris, he's from the New York Times, he's on their investigations team, and they have this article on Trump's taxes. All the politics aside, if you're into web development, we'll have a link to this in the show notes. Go look at the article, scroll down about a third of the way. There's a bar graph.
Yeah.
This is a bar graph with the bars are aligned along an x-axis, but they go down.
Yeah.
And what they did was they built this bar graph with the story text flowing around the bars.
The explanation was that it was to really kind of accentuate because the scale is towards the end, it gets pretty big.
Yeah, yeah. It's a case of where the bar graph itself, like at one end, it's, you know, it's pretty shallow, and then you start getting really, really long, and it would take up a ton of vertical space.
Yeah.
And you'd have a lot of white space then on the left-hand side. So they came up with this idea using a bar graph. Now, the bar graph is done with, like, SVGs and stuff. You can go into that if you want to. But what they figured out was by using a little bit of CSS overflow, which isn't a big deal, but using then before pseudo selectors and a fancy shape outside setting, they basically made a clipping path along the overflowed section of the chart to make it look like, and this is really exactly what you were just saying, Aaron.
Yeah.
It's not flowing around the bar graph.
Right.
It's flowing around the clip path they created.
Right.
Which just happens to approximate the shape of
the
bar graph line close enough that it looks correct.
Yeah.
So it's like, it isn't the exact, it probably is, you know, it's not the way it would look if it was a perfect kind of flow, but
yeah,
it's certainly the kind of outcome that you would want from that. And it's that kind of like, it's a super creative solution to making that text flow in a way that isn't just, you know, cut off or floated.
Back in the mid-2000s, we did a similar trick called div sandbags. And I don't have the link because I don't think the blog is up anymore, but I guess I could look. But it was essentially, you had like an image that had maybe it was right aligned, and then the left side of the image had kind of a curvy profile. And so you would stack divs that were floated towards the side that the image was on, and just of varying widths, and they would all be like, you know, float right, clear right. And right. So it would just be like a series of boxes of varying widths, and then the text would, you know, flow around those. And it was kind of cool. Like it gave it a neat like visual appeal that was non-linear.
You were basically creating a really low resolution outline.
Yes. Yes, exactly.
Using the edges.
So, not nearly as cool as this.
The chat thing reminds me a lot too of that, the old malicious CSS story, remember?
Yeah, right. How
people figured out you could use CSS to track people,
right?
Because of, you know, using the background images and things like that, that you could create behavior triggers, basically. And that's kind of what the CSS chat is doing. It's exploiting the same kind of technique, just not maliciously. But that is how, if you go in and read the GitHub that we'll have linked, he's got in the readme, like kind of how it works. And we sat here ourselves and mulled over, because I kept reading it and I kept saying over and over, that doesn't work that way.
Yeah.
But it does, because it's really almost novel the way they accomplished it by leaving the page in a loading state.
Right.
And because I was like, oh, I see how they're receiving data. I get that now. But I'm like, you can't send it. CSS doesn't send data.
Right.
It does.
With and get they requests.
They use a server sitting in the middle of that to translate these get requests and feed it to both pages that are receiving data. It's real wild, quite frankly.
I think we mentioned this before, maybe on the last time we talked about this stuff. There was a thing where someone would take like an animated GIF and they would send it down to the user, but then it would be sent without the terminating bytes in the GIF. So like, and they would use that as an open channel to send down data. And it was basically like creating an open socket connection with the browser using this image tag.
One of these days, somebody is going to message us and be like, you guys are idiots. Your code constantly says JIF. And so now I want to design a shirt for us that's just like JYFE across the front of it.
I always spell it, whenever I like spell it on Twitter, I always spell it ZHAIF. Like rhymes with wife.
JIF for life. So if you're interested in all of this stuff, the CSS hover, how data is getting passed back and forth and all this, there was one other guy that you found, Aaron, that...
Oh, yeah. It was.
I mean, his name is just Davey on Twitter.
Yeah.
Davey WTF.
He was linked. It was the Kevin on the GitHub. Kevin says that this is the person that inspired the idea. And he basically did essentially the same thing, but tracking your mouse position by seeing what you're hovering over and then just having a big grid of divs on the page. And then when you hover over an image, it makes a call to a background image that makes a get request with the coordinates.
Yeah, it when you see, because he's got a video of this in action, and that was where the light bulb went off for me for how the chat was accomplishing it.
Right, right.
Seeing it done like unidirectionally then made it make sense bidirectionally. So go check that out. It's cool. It's absolutely not usable. Like, you would never in your life build a chat system this way. It is purely proof of concept, but
it's a neat
experiment.
Maybe other data being transferred this way. I don't know. Like, I think that if this does have an application, it's going to be something kind of maybe oddball
or dangerous.
Hacky. Or dangerous. Yeah. Probably dangerous.
That's why we say, like, all of this reminded me of the malicious tracking stuff, and that's I don't like that.
Still cool stuff, though. Thank you, Kevin.
I want to get into our main topic first by doing one of these standard boilerplate disclaimers that I am not a lawyer. Aaron is definitely not a lawyer. My God. Put a shirt on once in a while, man. We are not giving you legal advice.
The bar exam that we take is not the barrister exam.
That's clever. I like that. Thank you for that. But we are going to be talking about GDPR tonight. It is the 1 year anniversary of the launch of GDPR on May 25th. And so we wanted to take this time. We had episode 11 was when this first came up. That was on, right. I think it was May 28th of last year. So GDPR had just launched. And so we were like, hey, here's a bunch of stuff so you can get started. And now is 1 year later. And so I thought it would be neat to sit down and kind of look at some of what's come out since then, mm-hmm. where we are, and where you should be as a developer. So I will apologize in advance because this will be more of a policy show, for lack of a better term. But if you want to jump in later in the show and just get the developer-y bits. But
you should listen to the whole
thing. You should listen to the whole thing, I think. Yeah,
I
definitely agree.
Michael will surely make some funny jokes in the first half.
Funny joke! Thank you for giving me that opportunity. I appreciate it. There's a quote in a CNBC article I came across, which is kind of what said, oh, yeah, we need to talk about this because it's funny. It said, among some consumers, GDPR is perhaps best known as the bothersome series of rapid-fire pop-up privacy notices. Those astronomical fines have failed to materialize. The law has created new bureaucracies within corporations, and with those, tension and confusion. And it's unclear if the EU data authority that oversees the law is adequately staffed to handle its demands.
Oh my gosh.
Like, this thing is just like Mike Tyson coming into the ring to yeah. give the middle finger to GDPR. It's like, this thing sucks for everybody.
It's like if IRS didn't exist before, and then suddenly it does, and it has like three people working, and they're like, all right, everybody send us money.
Oh, yeah. And that has been a big part of the problem, and we'll get into this a little bit more here in a little bit, that staffing is a problem. Quite frankly, mm-hmm. And it's in part because you're trying to staff up not just at the companies, but within the government organizations for something that didn't exist before 2016.
Mm-hmm.
And so corporations are going to lawyers and asking, how do we comply with this? Mm-hmm. There aren't a lot of lawyers that know it well. And the lawyers that just read it and try to interpret it don't understand.
Yeah.
They don't have somebody to go to ask questions because most of the places are already, you know, getting buried by actual work related to this.
Right.
So it has created a big problem. So there's this article from the International Association of Privacy Professionals. Say that three times fast because popsicles. I sure as hell can't.
People in popsicles.
They put out an article looking at 1 year of this. And one of the things that they noted is that a lot of the problems and challenges folks have faced with GDPR have been very logistical in nature, not technical, not like on the development okay. side. It's problems with like who needs to know what, collect what, and have access to what.
Logistical on the side of the people serving content, or logistical on the side of like the consumer?
Yes.
Okay. Okay.
A lot of these issues do very much cross apply as far as you know where the problems lie, and it makes for an interesting tug of war over whose needs went out. Now, folks in the EU and in the GDPR offices would tell you that the consumer always wins out in these arguments because, man, there was a good quote on this in one of the articles in the show notes, but I couldn't tell you which one. But it's this idea that businesses don't exist to process data. Mm. They process data to do business.
Okay. Okay.
It's sort of like that, but it's this idea that businesses need to come to this realization that they can't just hoard all this data on the hopes that they may need it later, kind of thing, is what he's driving at.
Right.
Even though a lot of businesses do work in that mentality, and sometimes they don't even realize they're doing that, you know? Sometimes they're collecting data just because they think it's reasonable.
Well, you know, I remember when I was at Cornell and we first rolled out Google Analytics, we didn't have anyone to use it. Like, no one was asking for it or anything, but it was just like, we might as well collect this data. And I think it was like 2 or 3 years before anyone asked for it.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and so a corollary question to this that is getting raised at a lot of places is, how do you adapt not the technology, but the business processes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are a lot of organizations, and even with our company where I work, one of the big challenges has been this idea of getting everybody to understand that we can't just collect all the information we want because we want it, and we can't keep it if we're not using it. Those go against GDPR. And as a consequence, it's leaving especially marketers, because marketers, at least US-based marketers, aren't thinking about this a lot.
Right.
The people who are thinking about it are the legal offices, the HR offices, and the web developers. And you're left with these groups constantly, you know, sort of talking to each other occasionally and trying to patchwork these solutions together, but more often than not, trying to explain why they can't do something or how to, you know, change the way they're doing something, even though the business doesn't want to.
Right. So, like, is it doing things that are helping consumers? Like, is it doing the thing it's meant out to be, even though its implementation is maybe not perfect?
I mean,
like, what kind of complaints are coming in?
Well, so far, like, from a website standpoint, if you go over to Lexology, they've got an article that kind of breaks down some of this. And one of the things they noted was that a majority of the complaints are not aimed at websites.
Huh.
They noted, like, the complaints that are coming to data protection authorities were things like complaints about telemarketing, complaints about getting promotional emails that they didn't request.
Okay.
And, you know, and this is something that's maybe a little more specific to the EU than the US, but requests to have, like, surveillance and CCTV data erased.
Oh. Huh.
Because that applies. Like, GDPR is not just based on websites. It's based on
data privacy.
It's data.
Fascinating.
And data covers a huge umbrella of information. And so a lot of those requests have been coming into that. One of the problems that, like, businesses have found as a consequence is that, like, they're supposed to have a data protection officer so that when data protection authorities come to them, there is this person responsible for executing on these requests.
Okay. Okay.
This is hard because you inherently have to hire somebody who might be working against the business interests of your company. Because this is the person, they are there to be an advocate for the consumer, not for the business. You can outsource it. A business can hire out the role of a data protection officer to a service, certainly. But a lot of companies want that in-house because that person may have to deal with, you know, proprietary information or, you know, this, that, or the other. That's a challenge because let's say, you know, marketing is sitting on a database of, you know, 10 million records that they've collected over the last 20 years.
Yeah.
It's the DPO's job to go in there, look at that, and say, we need to delete every record over, like, 5 years old.
Yeah.
Because we can't retain data indefinitely if we aren't using it. Now, let me be clear, you know, let's presume that that's just a database of stuff they've collected they aren't using.
But sure.
Because we're digital hoarders, you know, there isn't really a cost, or hasn't up until now been a cost, to just keeping data in case.
Yeah.
Interesting side effect of that is there was an article, I'll see if I can find it because I hadn't thought about it before this, but there was an article about AI training.
Huh.
Because AI inherently needs, it was something, because it was an article dealing with, like, Alexa and Google Home and the way,
I just
said Alexa and it came on. Sorry, Alexa. Don't mind me. I'm not talking to you. Hey, it turned off.
Alexa.
But they use like all the voice recordings that they save up to be continuously training the voice models. And of course this freaks people out. They hate the idea that their voices are being kept and all of this stuff. I personally have my own feelings, not important, but that there is a valid thing there to say, yeah, but we need large data sets of historical information to train against.
Well, that was what Google Voice was, wasn't it? When you signed up for Google Voice, there's a privacy thing in there that I'm sure no one read, where they were using Google Voice data because, you know, you get your voicemails and then
you're supposed to like on it.
Yeah, and you're supposed to tell it like, oh, this word was wrong, and then you correct it, and then that helps train their AI to better understand the voice. And then now they have, then they turn that into Google Translate, and then now they do all kinds of crazy stuff with calling robots and
so there's this very real sort of thinking in the business world that, well, we may need that later, but most data doesn't fall into that. Like, those are, I think, very specific cases a lot of time. And in many of those, you can anonymize it and do other things that would allow, you know, strip it of its personally identifiable, you know, information. If you just need, like, an archive of images, you know, you could have that blur out the faces or whatever, but still use it to do like road recognition or things like that.
Right.
So there's also this confusion that I mentioned between like the technical and the legal and the business responsibilities. And the DPO is that person who sort of needs to be able to speak all of those languages to pull those people together.
Okay.
Because they're,
we just talked about this recently. That's like kind of like having an accessibility person.
Yeah.
Right?
A little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, because they have to have a foot in several of those worlds, because if, you know, if somebody puts in a GDPR request, like they want to have their stuff deleted, and the technical people haven't built the stuff, and the business can't respond within 30 days, and then legal gets a letter that says, you have not complied, you know, the DPO is the person who kind of gets on the hook for whether or not those three parts of the wheel are working together. So let's talk about enforcement of this, because that's really where we get into like the boondoggle of all of this.
Right.
Let's, because one of the things you haven't heard a lot of, right, are things about fines.
Yeah.
Where are all the fines at? Because you were asking, is it effective? Has it done what it was set out to do? On one hand, the answer is yes. We'll talk about that here in a little bit about like the mandatory reporting component of it. Mandatory reporting has worked extremely well. But the fining aspect of it, the part that is meant to make companies be more considerate of user privacy, hasn't really worked. One of those reasons is that there are five different EU nations that still haven't ratified it.
Right.
So Bulgaria, Czech Republic, Greece, Portugal, and Slovenia.
Slovenia. Okay.
None of them have ratified GDPR yet. So there's a giant space of gray.
What's the consequence of that? Like, if they don't ratify it?
Oh, man, I couldn't. That's getting into EU politics that I don't even have the slightest idea.
I wonder if they have, like, a time limit or else they have, like, sanctions from the EU or something.
My guess is it doesn't matter. Well, no, you laugh, but thinking about it, like, if somebody, you know, if there was a proposed amendment to the Constitution in the U.S. and 2/3 of the states ratify it, it doesn't matter if the other third do or don't ratify it.
Right.
It's still going to become the law. And so I think that's kind of the case here, is whether or not they individually ratify it is probably irrelevant to the fact that they're going to be required to still meet it.
Okay.
And then if they don't, it becomes an internal EU affair. Like, that has nothing to do with the data side.
Mm-hmm.
So far, fines have been in the area of $58 to $60 million US.
Wow. Damn.
Sounds like a lot, doesn't it?
I mean, it does, but I see that is for what Google was assigned. Which
Google got $57 million of that.
Yeah.
So Google, one fine to Google was like 90% of the total fines in 2018.
Hold on. Humans suck at big numbers. I'm looking up.
It's 0.04% of their revenue.
Thank you.
I remember that number.
Yeah.
Facebook got fined. Folks probably have heard about that. A whopping $645,000.
So, by comparison, wait, you said 0.04%?
0.04. Yeah, it's nothing.
So that'd be, if you earned the median income of $50,000, that'd be getting fined $20.
Right.
So you got like a parking ticket, basically.
It's nothing, yeah.
Yeah.
Now, granted, this had to do with, I think, AdSense or AdWords, one of those. And how they were processing data and not getting consent or something. Is there something there? And that that becomes problematic. There's a quote from Odia Kagan, the chair of the GDPR compliance program for Fox Rothschild. And she said, I still feel like unless there is a very significant increase in staffing, they're probably going to have to pick and choose the enforcement actions that they bring.
Hmm.
That is a terrible way to apply law. Like, that is the worst way to apply law. And that's, I think, where, like, I see these fines. And while, you know, it's only a handful, I think, you know, I think it's less than a dozen fines in total have been levied.
Yeah.
Most of it at Google, Facebook, another small one, Uber got one, I remember.
It's interesting that Facebook's fine is so much smaller than Google's, given that Facebook is still a huge revenue generator and all the stuff in.
Well, yeah. I don't remember what the nature of Facebook's fine was, because there's mitigating factors that come into play. Was it intentional? Was it ongoing? Was
right.
it one time? You know,
but with all the stuff in the news recently about Facebook's data collection stuff, you know, like I'm surprised that Facebook wasn't closer to Google's.
There's still, you know, half the cases that have been filed, like half of them are still open.
Because
again, and just back to this quote, that there is a staffing problem. What we were saying earlier, that the nations themselves are still working to try to figure out how to get enough people into these bureaucracies to handle the volume of stuff that's coming in. And it's a volume that is only going to increase over time. That's a huge problem because it creates inconsistency and sends no clear messages to companies with respect to how to apply this law to their processes.
Mm-hmm.
And more to the point, it becomes a huge problem because the way it's being applied now, it's getting thrown at the big companies and none of the small ones, basically.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember. And the Facebook one had something to do with Cambridge Analytica, by the way.
Okay.
I do remember
that. Oh, right.
It was like an ancillary component of that.
Huh.
We've seen some of the reverse of that in the U.S. when it comes to like copyright and patent trolling.
Right.
A lot of that gets aimed at the small companies.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're going after the little, you know, bite-sized chunks trying to get settlements and they cast a wide net.
Well, because that's about revenue generation and GDPR is about, well, ostensibly about consumer protection.
Right. Because here's the thing. Keep in mind that at least my understanding is the fines under GDPR, they don't go to the person making the complaint.
Right.
That's just money the government is collecting.
Right.
So, and that's one of those, I'm going to reserve the right to be wrong on that. But, you know, it's that as far as like, people cashing in, that's just not a thing.
Yeah.
So the incentive is actually reversed there. They want to get the big settlements and smack down these giant corporations that are kind of flaunting the law. There's nothing to be gained by the work that would have to go in to policing all the small ones.
Right.
That's a problem, as you know, in my eyes, because it's creating two sets of standards where there isn't. Now, there is an article over at align.com that, and this is actually, I'm going to share their article, but it's mentioned in a lot of them, that pretty much everybody does think that stronger enforcement is on the way.
Yeah.
Everybody's kind of referred to this. When France issued their fine against Google, they mentioned like, this is a transition year. This is year one of GDPR. We're all figuring it out. We're all getting our processes and people and steps together. So they're all looking towards the next 2 to 5 years of really figuring this out. And once you do, that's where they are going to see stronger enforcement. And we don't know what that looks like yet.
Here's a question. So let's imagine the GDPR was applied 30 years ago, would all these companies and countries be in compliance then? I know that like internet didn't exist in the way that it does now then. I just mean like the data that companies were collecting, would it be easier or similar or more difficult back then to comply with it?
Back then, if you're talking about like literally back then and not like today, sure, like, but 30 or like not saying like let's jump ahead to, you know, 2050 and look back.
No, I mean like literally before we had, because we have so much big data now. So imagine it's like in the 80s or maybe the late 70s when almost everything was paper-based or maybe mainframe-based in some cases.
Well, yeah, because that goes back to this when I said, you know, digital hoarding doesn't have a cost.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, for lack of right. a better term, it does. I mean, I know realistically there is a...
But it's negligible.
Yeah.
Yeah. So is this a problem that has come because of the big data and data collection, data hoarding?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay. So like,
because there's this up is, until now, there's just never been a consequence.
Right.
You know, think about in the US, every time Target announced a data breach, you know, mm-hmm. think about all of these companies that have had, you know, Adobe, LinkedIn, all of these companies that yeah. have had user data leaked out and stolen. And what have the consequences of that ever been?
Not much.
Right. I know yeah. there have been a couple cases that where fines have happened. Let's go to the big one. That was recent. Equifax.
Right. That one there was they had the thing where you could sign up for free credit reporting. Right. But remember, I think we covered this on the podcast before. Someone made a fake Equifax site.
Yeah.
To collect data. They didn't even know.
They were one of the companies that also have been fined under the GDPR. Not a lot,
huh.
but they have, yeah. they were one of the few that have gotten fines in the last year. But, you know, that too, though, the cost to them was effectively, yeah. you know, $50 worth of credit monitoring the people.
Yeah.
And, you know,
if they opt in.
Yeah, if they opted into it. And
yeah.
then it's, you know, it was that classic joke of, I don't want to give Equifax more of my data to get to do that now. Why would I trust them to do that now? That's ridiculous.
Well, so the reason I ask that question though is it sounds like the problem is that we've been undisciplined with our data collection practices.
Oh,
because
totally.
If this problem wouldn't have existed in the way that it does now, back in the 80s, like if these laws were applied back then, then it seems like maybe we've just been kind of drunk on what's possible. Like the Ian Malcolm thing from earlier.
Yeah.
You know, like we never would think if we should be collecting this, just if we could.
And it also comes back to this idea, and this is going to come up at the end of the show, about having to retroactively apply fixes now is a huge yeah. problem. Most of these systems were not built from the ground up to comply with things like, you know, right to be forgotten, right to data transportation, all these things.
Mm-hmm.
Because they weren't built to support it, trying to retroactively go back and build this stuff on is just like, to go back to the other comment you made, accessibility. It's
yeah.
so hard to retrofit these things onto these giant data silos. And companies that have had, think about a big organization like Google or Microsoft or Facebook. And
yeah.
it's not like your information is in one table, in one system. Right. Like, it's scattered across hundreds of systems.
Yeah.
And how to unify that? Like, they, you know, have internal things that unify it into your Facebook page or whatever. But to be able to go in and delete that, you know, from other people's mentions and things, because keep yeah. in mind, your right to be forgotten is absolute across their system, not just your account.
Right. If it be completely non-exist.
Yeah.
You know, I wonder, I was just thinking, like, if, you know, if we had GDPR here and someone filed a complaint against a company.
Soon.
So, if that happened, how do you know if you're compliant? Like, how do they know if you're compliant? I mean, you can erase the superficial stuff. That's actually not that hard. But, like, you're required to scrub logs and caches and backups. And I mean, everything.
This is a great segue into our next section, which is the catch-22 of GDPR.
Imagine that. It's like I planned it or something.
So here's the thing about all of that. Let's talk about the people side, because GDPR, at its heart and soul, is about us, or
right.
more accurately, our EU counterparts.
Specifically, you and I.
Yes, yeah, you and me. We actually wrote the law, so blame us.
Yeah, it only applies to us.
People are inherently untrustworthy of corporations and the way they handle our data.
I can't imagine why.
Yet, we absolutely fork it over to them.
Right.
Even though, and I'm going to say something that may be unpopular, by and large, I think corporations are relatively trustworthy. I am not a firm believer that things like, you know, data retention policies and stuff would significantly reduce the risks of data leaks and mm-hmm. breaches and things. Like, yes, it would mitigate some of it, but I don't think it would mitigate much of it.
I was just thinking how you were saying how we readily fork over our data to these companies. And do you remember before social media existed, you could get those toolbars for your browser?
Oh, God, yeah.
And sometimes they wouldn't be malware, like, you know, or like you could get the...
They sent me a check every month, man. Shut up.
Remember, like, they had the thing where you could get, like, the animated smiley faces for Yahoo Messenger or whatever? But by loading that plugin in, it was also tracking your data.
I still remember the name. I used a tool called All Advantage.
Huh.
Was the name of the one I had. And yeah, I did the thing where you got the tool that moved your mouse around the screen randomly so that it would track your usage of the computer even when you weren't there. Because they were, you know, they paid you a dime an hour or whatever for letting you run it. I was a kid. I didn't care. I was getting a check every month. I got like $30 a month out of that.
Nice.
God knows what they collected on me during that period. That was the 90s. I don't even know what there was useful to get out of that at that point.
God, $30 in the 90s. That's like $100,000 today.
As a kid? That was awesome.
Yeah.
They didn't know. They just sent me a check. They didn't care how old I was.
Like two CDs. Anyways.
Yeah, I mean, long story short, I mean, I know there's the whole argument about, yeah, our company's really trustworthy, whatever. The reality is, you know, I don't care if they market to me. I don't care if they know when I poop. I don't care if they know what my house temperature is set to. That's not useful data to me, and frankly, I don't really see the point in being protective of it. And by and large, I don't feel like I've ever had that abused by a company. Sure, I've gotten like a mailer when I've looked at something on a website and then something came in the mail and it's like, I don't know how you even got my address. But it's not like they're a criminal.
You see, the thing that I'm worried about, though, is, as we sort of saw this a little bit with the data from, was it Ancestry or one of the, like, you spit in a tube and send it off and they tell you, like,
yeah,
where your people are from.
I think it was 23andMe is the thing you're thinking of.
Okay. So there was a thing where they were potentially sharing your information with third parties.
Right.
And I, like, I did do 23andMe before, and I immediately went on and I was like, opt out of everything, please. I don't want to be part of that. And I'm just trusting them that they will honor that. But it's the thing that I'd be concerned about is, like, so, you know, Google's wiretap may know what your home temperature is, and they may hear you talking. And they may know how often you have a dog in the room, you know, or those sorts of things. And, like, on their own, like, those individual items aren't particularly, like, juicy or anything. But then, like, as this rolls out more to more places and the Internet of Things starts collecting data from everywhere, and then they start sharing data across each other, you can then draw connections about people. And I can't even fathom the ways it could be used against you, but I'm just imagining anything where there's, like, risk mitigation or risk minimization for against the consumer, that's where it's going to be exploited. If, for example, with 23andMe sharing your genetic data with an insurance company and how that might affect your life insurance or health insurance premiums.
Sure.
So something like that, but, like, looking at, oh, how often does he keep his, you know, house warm? And then if it's, like, frequently low, then they're going to infer that you probably aren't home very often. or something. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
Because it does come down to a lot of different factors. And to your question about, like, you know, the people side of this, mm-hmm. one of the challenges is actually that it's good to put the user in control of this stuff, but that doesn't mean they get it.
Yeah.
And one of the things that has come up, and you'll hear this again later, is privacy blindness. And we've been hit with so many of the emails because of the launch of GDPR. We've been hit with so many of the pop-ups. We've been hit with so many of the consent checkboxes that you're not paying any more attention to what consent you're giving most of the time than you right. do when you hit the accept button on terms of service.
Right, the EULA.
nobody is paying attention. And even if they were, I would reckon that most people wouldn't know the actual details of the things they are and aren't giving authorization to, especially mm-hmm. at a company where they may have 10, 12, 15 different consents that they ask you for.
Right.
This makes it incredibly hard to build a solution that is right for those users. There's an article over at Payment Source that broke down a couple different surveys that were sent out to EU mm-hmm. corporations. And one, they said that 20% of the companies thought they were compliant, and another mm-hmm. 50% had started work on it.
You know what would be really cool? This wouldn't solve all of the GDPR problems, but it would maybe address the website ones. You have an Android phone, right?
Yeah.
You know when you install a new app and then the app says, this device would like these permissions, and then you have to like agree mm-hmm. to each of the things. And so I'm pretty sure that what happens there is that when a device includes the library that accesses your camera or your photos or your contacts or anything, then it triggers that on the install. The install says, oh, this device is using these libraries, so we need to affirm that you're okay with that. What if something like that was present on the web browser where, well, I guess it wouldn't really matter for data collection, but I mean, if you're consenting to have things tracked when you interact with the website, if a website had to, for the JavaScript use or whatever, if they had to say like, we want to use these features in the DOM or what have you, then the website would then intelligently know, these are the things that I may ask you about. And then the people would just have an easy form that says like, yes, no, whatever.
I hate the way it sounds. I mean, I'm not even going to try to sugarcoat it. It sounds terrible. That sounds like an internet I don't want to use.
But they're already doing that.
I know.
Like, they just have it in, like, fine print.
The little notification pop-ups. Can I use your location? Mm-hmm. Do you want to get notifications from us? I hate all of them. They're annoying.
Yeah.
I don't, because if I'm going to your website to read an article on how to build something or what happened in Alabama yesterday or whatever, that information doesn't mm-hmm. impact your ability to complete the thing I need to do.
Right. Well, what if it was just something like in the browser Chrome itself, and not the Chrome browser, but the browser like frame,
yeah.
where it had a series of different icons. Maybe like one was like location service. One was like, I don't know, contact or email or whatever. And it would just, it only show the symbols that were possibly being used by the, or wanting to be used by the page, and then you would have to like opt into any of them that you're okay sharing. Like some, like on weather.com, I don't mind sharing my location because it helps
right.
my experience. But on a site like if I was buying clothes or something, you don't need to know my location.
the thing is, I don't think that is the crux of the problem, because the thing is the whole consent issue deals with the things each individual company is doing, and every company is doing different, you know, different mm-hmm. things. The other study yeah. that was in this Payment Source article said that 20% of companies don't think compliance is even possible.
Yeah.
Because like with what you're describing, yeah, I mean, that's all well and good for like services.
Yeah.
But we're not necessarily, I mean, services certainly are included in that. But it's definitely not the deep end of the pool where everybody is swimming at.
I guess I'm trying to think about in terms of communicating to consumers. You know, the problem with fine print is that it says a lot of very important things in a very hard to consume and hard to read way. And they present it at a point when it's preventing you from getting the thing you want, like you mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
There has to be a way to kind of distill that down to like general terms that are fair and reasonable to the consumer that also are easy to understand, you know, like for example, like location tracking, or, you know, this site is going to collect your name. Are you okay with that?
Yeah.
I don't even know all the things that they have to.
There's a name for this, and I'm going to save it because I've got it here towards the end. So let me get into one more stat, and then okay. We can talk about that. The other stat comes from TechRadar real fast. That is, they asked a bunch of corporations, or not, they didn't ask a bunch of corporations. They were reporting on a study done, and a guy went out and put out GDPR requests to a bunch of companies, and then measured the outcomes. And what he found was that only 17% of his requests were in compliance with the requirements of GDPR, with 9% of them came back on top of that, delayed or incomplete.
Wow.
So an incredibly small, that's 26%, you know, met the request. But to what you were saying earlier, and to the idea of the catch-22, how, as a user, do you even know?
Yeah, like if they tell you, like, oh yeah, like you're completely gone for our databases, like how do you know?
there is a measure of trust that has to happen there, and there's a gap in coverage that I don't know how to cover, and I don't know. Maybe it doesn't need to be. Maybe there's no value in trying to solve that particular problem, because the thing is, if they say, oh yeah, we scrubbed you from our system, and then next week you get an email from them, then you have immediate and instant information that they didn't scrub you from their system.
Or worse, if they said that they scrubbed you from their system, but then they have a data breach, maybe, let's say, a year later.
Oh yeah.
So like if you wrote to Equifax and you said, per GDPR, I'd like you to remove, like, make me not exist as far as you're concerned. And then the year later, they got hacked and there's a data breach.
The Scarlet Letter version of this is the Ashley Madison hack from, 3 years ago?
Oh, yeah. Oh, man.
That would be a good example of that. Like, obviously, this wasn't in effect then, but if something like that were to occur with a site like that, especially. So the end of the show is this big section called Why Do I Care as a Developer? And if you
part two,
because you've heard us talk about some of this, and some of this will be repeated, but it's because it's still important, and I think people still need to hear it. Step number one, I do not care if you are a developer based in the U.S. The GDPR still affects you, and stop pretending like it doesn't. It is dangerous to take that mentality. I'll tell you, and Aaron, I don't know if you are in any like Ruby subreddits or not, but I kick around some of the WordPress subreddits and things like that, and watching conversations about GDPR makes me want to cry the way people talk about it outside the EU, because it's dangerous.
I don't really use Reddit. I haven't used Reddit in like a few years because I got tired of using if Dunning-Kruger was a website. Because that was most of my experience. It sounds like that hasn't changed.
It's tough because people are anchored to this idea of, well, it's you know, if it's in the EU, why, I don't have to care. Yeah, you do. Because A, you may work for a company someday that does business in the EU, and now you got to care about it. But more importantly, this idea that, oh, the EU laws don't apply to the US is extremely bad advice to give somebody, because that's not the way law works. The U.S. has things called trade agreements, and with those trade agreements comes a reciprocity component for certain laws, especially as they apply to anything related to things like intellectual property, trademark, and data privacy. Now, yeah. As far as I know, this has not been tried in the U.S. yet.
Right.
There hasn't been a fine levied against a purely U.S. company. Facebook, Google, Uber, these are companies that have a presence in the EU. But that doesn't mean that it couldn't work. It just mm-hmm. means nobody has pushed it hard enough. But they totally could, and they would very likely be able to win it. And that's something, telling people not to worry about it is terrible advice.
We had, at Ruby by the Bay, we had a fellow from, I want to say he was from Russia. He's from Eastern European somewhere. But he was asking if we were GDPR compliant and for diaper base. And I mean, we're not, but we also only service people in the US. Yeah. So
you're only dealing with US based entities purely.
Yeah. So I, and it's such a limited audience too. So yeah.
Let me ask this question though. Mm-hmm. If I'm in France and I want to set up a mm-hmm. diaper bank, I could still download diaper base and run my own version of it. Couldn't I?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you could be in France and you could use our application in France and it would probably still work. I think like the addresses and things that we use are formatted for US addresses, but like if we had an international user, I'm actually kind of hoping like Rails has all this really cool internationalization stuff built into it, like where it just automatically translates stuff when you provide it with the content. And I really want to use it, but we just don't have any reason to yet.
I mean, it'd be interesting to see that theory tested. If somebody wanted to set up a diaper bank in another country using your software, now mm-hmm. you are processing the data of EU people, and you are now.
Yeah, then it would apply.
You are under the umbrella. So, what I would think there is, you either need to like build in a hard limitation to the US into the tool.
Well, we would know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, because you've got a finite and manageable number of.
For now, yeah.
or build the tooling into it that allows, you know, proper.
Yeah.
Proper compliance. And I don't think it would be hard in your case, but.
I don't know. There might already be a gem for this, but if there isn't, I bet there would be a lot of use for like a GDPR gem where if you give it like a name or a user record or something, it sort of like facilitates the scrubbing process.
Right. That's kind of like what WordPress has added.
Yeah.
They've added that ability to. I forget. I haven't used it yet, so I don't know how the implementation itself works. But it's basically a way you can flag things you add to the database as being
mm-hmm.
Like GDPR tagged, so to speak. Because they have a tool now in the back end where you can go in to delete people out of your system and to facilitate requests.
Oh, that's cool. So you flag something as being this is GDPR
right.
material, and then that way if you ever have to pull it, it's just you have all the hooks in place. Yeah.
And you can do it in a way, like, if you get clever, for instance, if there's mm-hmm. user-contributed data, like posts or something, you know, you could pull off the personally identifiable pieces without getting rid of, like comments, I think, are one of those spaces. You don't necessarily want comments to be deleted because it would break the flow, you know, of that. But you can remove all of the personally identifiable pieces to that. Still huge problems when it comes to what if I type my name into the comment,
right?
Because that is still subject to a GDPR right to be forgotten from a very technical standpoint.
Oh, by the way, last addendum on that. I just looked and there is a GDPR_Rails gem that is specifically about GDPR compliance management for a Rails application.
So your homework is to bring that back on the next episode and tell us how to use it.
There's also just a plain GDPR Ruby gem. I don't know. I literally just looked these up. I don't know if they're any good, but those do exist. So if you're, I don't know if we have any European listeners, but if we do, and you're a Rails dev, there you go.
The last point on why you should care in the US is because it's coming to the US next year. Because if you haven't heard of the California Consumer Privacy Act, it's mm-hmm. coming in 2020. And it's the California version of the GDPR. And you may not do business in France or Germany, but I bet you probably have a good chance of doing business in California.
I can't tell if the California version of this is going to be better or worse.
Yeah, I really don't. And for all the reading,
I would think worse, but like the GDPR seems like such a clusterfuck that maybe it's better. I don't know.
For everything I've read about GDPR and how deep my nose has gotten into it with the work we've been doing, I don't know much about California's version. They have, if you go to their website, they've got like a 10-point list of all the things that it's supposed to do, which, you know, it stopped me if these sound familiar, but right to know all data collected by a business on you, right to say no to the sale of your information security, right to delete data that you have posted, right to not be discriminated against if you tell a company not to sell your personal information. Interesting point about that, because this comes back to what you were saying with like the browser bits and pieces and everything. Yeah. This idea that if I say no to things, I should still be able to get a minimum amount of service from your application.
Right.
Like if I don't consent to the way you want to use my data, and that lack of consent is irrelevant to the action I'm asking to take, I should be able to take that action. And that's...
Well, even if it's something where you have to set up a profile, like if they need a name, they don't really need your name. Unless your name is somehow actually necessary, you could give them Joe Schmo.
If your forum needs your birthday,
you could just give them the year of your birth. Or, you could just lie.
Not at all. Let's try not at all.
Or just say, yes, I'm over this age. Just attesting I am this old.
Well, as part of that, it's funny you mentioned that. Number 7 on the list is mandated opt-in before sale of children's information under the age of 16.
Whoops.
So there's this whole list, and all of these will sound very familiar as far as that goes. So if you think the U.S. is safe, and didn't we just mention, what, 2 or 3 shows ago, I think one of the warmer topics that we started with was the deal going through Congress, that they have been given the green light to pursue legislation that would mimic what the GDPR is doing.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
That's right.
So while, I mean, that does, nothing has been written yet. The door was kicked wide open that said that I think it was the CBO or one of those or one of the watchdog organizations came back and said, yeah, cool, go for it.
It's a good thing that there aren't any like really big companies in California that deal a lot with user data, you know.
So this gets into this idea as a developer, and I run into it a lot. There was something I was talking to somebody about the other day that fell into this idea that HTML and CSS is so easy. Like, it's so easy to become a web developer. And it's like, yeah, okay. But being good at being a web developer is incredibly hard.
We have Aaron tool analogy.
Yeah, Aaron is a tool. And that's the way we are going to describe this.
No, I was thinking that it's like, you know, anyone can swing a hammer or saw a plank or like screw a screwdriver or whatever, but it doesn't mean that you can build.
You screw screws with the screwdriver. You don't screw the screwdriver. We need to keep you away from tools.
That's what I'm doing wrong. Well, you can use tools, but it doesn't mean you can build a house with them.
Yeah.
And like HTML CSS isn't hard to learn. I mean, like to a degree. I don't know, the stuff we talked about earlier is like, whoa.
You could even build a house, but you can't guarantee you can get a wheelchair through the door. You can't be certain that your electrical won't start a house fire or that you won't die of carbon monoxide poisoning.
Wait, we didn't put this in the show notes, but before the show, Michael and I were looking at weird things on the internet, and we found a garden house. What did they call it?
Yeah, garden house. That's for sale on Amazon.
Yeah. We shared it in the random channel on our Slack channel. DrunkenUX.com/Slack. But you can, for $5,000 or $7,000, you can buy this little like 140 square foot. You described it as like a deck with a, not a hut, but like
a sunroom.
Yeah, a sunroom. That's kind of what it looks like. But it's basically just like a chassis.
It's an IKEA house.
Put whatever you want. Yes, that's actually a really
good description. It's an IKEA house. Yeah.
If IKEA made a small like guest house, like this would be it. And but that's kind of like, you know, like a website that, you know, you might build with
Wix.
WordPress.
Squarespace.
Squarespace, yeah.
But it is that idea, though, that sure, yeah, okay, if Joe Schmo down the street can go get their, you know, $10 a month Webflow account or whatever and set up a website, mm-hmm. but they don't really know what they've done, and they certainly can't mm-hmm. do the hard stuff that's related to it. Where GDPR fits into this is these are the skills, and we made a comment, I don't remember which episode it was on, but I remember this conversation about like CSS animations and mm-hmm. this idea that, yeah, learning basic CSS is incredibly easy, quite frankly.
Yeah.
But when you sit down and start looking at, or well, for instance, what we started the show off with.
Yeah.
Building a chat system with CSS. Yeah. Tell me CSS is easy, please.
I know we talked about doing bomb CSS on the show before, but apparently my bomb CSS is like, I don't know, like maybe like World War One grenade. And this is like tactical strike missiles.
Knowing things like how to build privacy aware systems and how to make something GDPR compliant is what will set you apart as a developer. It's the thing that when you apply for that job, I've got a job application out right now. I think I've got in my inbox a dozen different applications for at this point. And I'm mm-hmm. going to have to go through them and figure out who's going to get an interview, a first mm-hmm. interview, let alone a second. And the thing that is going to set people apart is if they can do the little things and show me that.
Yeah.
And if you can put in there, oh yeah, I have experience or at least an understanding of privacy concepts, that will set you yeah. apart from the people who are just like, heck yeah, I built websites in high school. It's like, yeah, that's a good starting point. But if you want to be a professional, if you want to be, you know, in this industry, if you want to be a contractor, you know, yeah. if you want to build houses, you have to know how to deal with legal compliance and things like that. And it's boring and it's not interesting and it's hard and it's counterintuitive, but we still have to do it. An example here is like if you're building something with a database, mm-hmm. you know, it's not just good enough to know, well, I can throw a table in that. Yeah, okay, making a table on a database is easy. Do you know how to include, you know, salts and encryption for user data? Do you know how to do pseudonymization on data? Do you know how to do data warehousing and siloing? I got it, didn't I? I said it.
You nailed it.
Yeah. It's the, man, Gentleman Jack has me talking like a gentleman. What can I say? Or wait, no, Gentleman Jack has me talking proper like a lady. Is that the joke? I don't know. The other side of this is not just building, but fixing. I mentioned this earlier that a lot of places you're going to get a job and you're going to walk into stuff that already exists. You're not going to have the opportunity mm-hmm. to build from scratch as much. You're going to be helping maintain or build on a system that has existed before you.
I would liken the privacy stuff to like security knowledge. You know, like we don't have to be good enough with security that we can do red teaming or blue teaming, but you have to be aware.
Yeah.
You have to know what SQL injection is. You have to know like how to stop basic cross-site scripting, just the low-hanging fruit so that you're not an easy target.
Right. So you had asked before, like, is this working? And I said specifically, let's wait till the end of the show because that's where this comes in. I feel like you're almost setting me up for these, and I'm not sure if you are. There were, and I don't know why this number varies because I feel like this is a number that should be known, but
mm-hmm.
there was a range that I was able to find. There were between 40 and 60,000 data breaches reported last year to GDPR authorities.
Oh, shit.
Yeah. Talk about, if you were to guess, I should have asked you to guess before I said that.
Is it 13?
It's more than 13, actually. It is 40 to 60,000.
Wow. Oh, wait, is that, okay, wait, are these numbers, are they more because the threshold has been lowered, so more are showing up? Are they more because there's just more compliance now? Or?
Yes. The answer is yes to everything. So,
okay.
One, prior to this, we, you know, as far as the EU goes, there wasn't like a place to report it really. To report a data breach, some countries did have, like Germany was one that comes to mind that did have a mandated reporting for a data breach, but it was totally ad hoc per country and who knows. So with the introduction of GDPR, you had mandated reporting and a place to report it to. Mm-hmm. So obviously reports went up. On top of that, in the same way, what constituted a data breach was normalized. You know, they went through and explained, like, for instance, if a database table leaked out with IP addresses in the U.S., that would not be a data breach in the U.S. because IP addresses are not considered personally identifiable, except in weird court cases, which I still don't understand. They still get used in court as personally identifiable sometimes, but it's not from a privacy standpoint considered personally identifiable. In the EU, it is. Okay. And that's been a fun question. Go look up some things like website access logs and GDPR compliance if you really want to have your brain hurt. Because IP addresses are personally identifiable. So that's that number, 40,000 to 60,000, is a 2 to 3-fold increase in the number of data breaches that have been reported as a result. And that is generally viewed as a positive because it means people are getting notified that their stuff is getting out there.
Yeah.
Also, that's a huge, like, that number is crazy in my eyes. Like, that's a lot of data breaches.
That's like, 5,000 a month?
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah.
I think they started at like 1,800 a month and it went up from there. So, yeah, talking about like understaffed departments, you know, dealing with that level of volume.
That's an average of 1,500 every day.
A lot of data breaches, and
it's basically just like data is just constantly leaking out.
You as a developer,
every few seconds,
you don't want to be the person getting blamed for one of those,
right? I don't know, man. If you have like 1,500 of those having every day, and your site suddenly has one, it's like I almost think it wouldn't be a big deal at that point.
But it should be. Damn it.
Like, oh, it's Tuesday.
But that's the thing. And like you were saying, you know, learning security, learning these things. And believe it or not, we've had an episode on web security.
What?
It has happened. Like, because these concepts are important for you not to know inside and out, but sometimes you need to know what you don't know. Because one of the biggest problems is this need to say yes. If somebody comes and says, hey, would you build the site for me? I need it to do X. You say yes. Mm-hmm. Oh, well, we'll just make a form for that and store the data in a database. And you can make it work. You can make it technically work. But that isn't good enough. And you need to know when that is not good enough and when to say, oh, yeah, we got to do that. But we need to make sure these things are taken care of. You know, it's going to cost, you know, a little extra because we have to build it this way. And it's no different than when you have to get your permits to build your house, you know, or, you know, to rip an electrical system out or to get lead paint remediation. Like, you have to go through steps. And yes, it's bureaucracy. And yes, it's getting in the way of stuff. But there are good reasons for that.
You know, I saw earlier today, I responded to a question on Quora.com, and the question was, is there a way to, the person was using a Rails app, and they wanted to ask for the credit card number, they wanted to do something with it, I don't remember what it was, but they weren't wanting to persist it in the database, they just wanted it to, like, have it in the form and then go to the controller. But my response was like, well, here's how you would do it. But you also want to make sure that you put it in your, like, filtered fields thing in your config so that it doesn't show up in your log files. And then also, maybe don't do this at all because, like, PCI compliance.
So where this kind of falls from a, like, front-end standpoint in particular is caring about all of this from a UX standpoint. And that comment we made earlier about, like people don't trust companies, but they also aren't smart enough to know how to handle all of the consent stuff that's thrown at them. And I mentioned this phrase, privacy blindness. We just start clicking buttons. And it's like, you gave me a pop-up and I see the word consent. I just want to read my damn article. I hit yes or no. And half the time I don't know if a yes or no is what I need.
Right.
Understanding that, A, as a developer, you need to avoid dark patterns to trick people into giving consent. You should never be tricking people into giving consent.
Mm-hmm.
it should be clear and affirmative what they're doing, but also making sure that you are building your consent tools and privacy tools in a way that makes it easy for people to understand and know what they're doing.
You know, last episode we talked about design systems, and this would have been a great opportunity for the EU to create a design system around GDPR.
Talk about it. Right? Talk about the golden nugget out of this episode. Man, I love that idea.
Yeah, so if hypothetically, if California was going to do that CA privacy thing, if they said, okay, if you have a website, here are some tools. This is some language you can use. These are some icons you can use, just to kind of standardize that compliance to kind of facilitate. This is what I was getting back to earlier, you know, communicating to the user. You want to do it as quickly as possible. It's just the compliance thing.
And the funny part about that is, like, when cookie compliance came up in the EU, they tried that. And at least in that case, because I don't think they executed it well. And the way it was done was bad. Like, it was done in a way that was legally correct, but not in a way that gave any kind of consideration to user experience. And then they kept changing the rule on top of, like, what constituted, you know, acceptance of cookies and whatnot. But there's an article over at UX Design by Claire Barrett called "What Does GDPR Mean for UX?" Go check that out. One of the things she brings up there, and this is kind of an answer to one of your questions earlier about, like, the what you could do in browser Chrome.
Right.
One of the concepts she brings up is just-in-time consent, which is, like, if you're, let's take the app analogy you were giving. If you download an app and you go to use the camera, a lot of apps then pop up a thing that says, hey, we need permission to use the camera. That's just-in-time consent. If you install the app and then it says, hey, we need to use the camera, but you haven't even asked to use the camera yet, that's not that.
I have declined to install apps before because they were asking for permission to use things that I felt they didn't need to be using.
And that, you know, that again gets into all this UX of privacy. Like, how do you convey to people that we need the thing we're asking for X, Y, and Z? Because there are cases like file system, let's say, and mobile device, I think, is a good example because there is at least a privacy model on them that's fairly standard that people are used to. Like, I need access to your files. And, like, at a very high level, especially when you're installing it, it's like, no, I don't want to give you access to my files. But the reality is they need that because they, you know, they're going to allow you to attach, you know, a picture to something or whatever. Like, there is a reason for it. Now, asking with a just-in-time consent message gives people at least some context to realize, oh, I'm asking to do this. You're confirming with me that it's okay, so I can connect those things. I can think of better ways to handle those, but that's neither here nor there.
Yeah.
Just-in-time consent fixes part of that.
I like that because it puts it, it's it puts the it sets the context right. The gulf of evaluation. That's a Donald Norman thing, right? The gulf of evaluation is narrowed because the user is being prompted very close in time to the thing that they have to do or the relevant part.
And asking people to consent to like 12 things when they're signing up for an account or whatever is, you'll see this phrase thrown around, it's consent fatigue or privacy fatigue. Like, you asking for a bunch of stuff all at once is, it goes back to what I was saying. You're tricking people into giving you consent is what you're trying to do. And I don't care about GDPR at that point. You are making a bad decision as a designer if that's what you're doing.
You know, the easier way around that would be maybe don't ask for this information and then you don't have to ask for consent.
Right. Yeah. The idea is, like, just-in-time consent solves the problem of ask for the thing that you need when you need it and nothing else.
Yeah.
If you look over at Prolific Interactive, Brad Arrigo has an article over there that also gets into this idea that there is no such thing as implied consent anymore either, which is an important note. At least, again, in terms of GDPR, you can't just say click yes and you also agree to our terms of service and to get marketing emails and all of that. That doesn't work. You can't do that. That's illegal You have to say, good. I agree to get marketing emails, and it has to be an affirmative checkbox kind of consent.
Okay.
And, yeah, what you're just saying, at the end of this, it all comes back to encouraging people to do the thing that I love any opportunity to say this. It's do less better. Do less better. Don't try to collect every piece of information on the planet about somebody. Don't try to get them to sign up for every single thing, whether or not that's what they're there to do. Let people do the minimum amount of stuff they want to do and give them an awesome way to do it.
I think that the thing I mentioned earlier, discipline, like we haven't had good data discipline coming this far because we haven't had to. And things like privacy laws are kind of enforcing better data discipline, both with how we manage and store the data, but also in considering whether, like, it's just, you know, not hoarding it anymore.
Yeah.
It's like, we got to get all KonMari with our data.
does this data bring you joy?
Yeah.
Yes, it does. I get to know everything about their personal life. I was going through their Alexa recordings. Let me tell you about what I heard there.
I think I like do less better, and I think that, you know, if you're concerned about this, I think step one is evaluate what you're already collecting and what can you not collect anymore. Do you really need the name of the users?
And every corporation doing business in the EU or with EU people is required to have a data protection officer. The data protection officer's role is to be an advocate for the users and their requirements and their privacy. But that doesn't mean that that responsibility begins and ends with them. Developers and designers and UX professionals and UI designers and QA people can all take part in that role and should be mm-hmm. taking part in that role. I said, I don't know if it was the last episode or the episode before, about this idea that one of the things our industry is missing is sort of an ethical code of conduct for our users.
Last episode.
Yeah. I thought it felt awfully fresh.
Because I mentioned the Root Strikers thing.
Ah, yes. But that's the thing that we're missing, and it's that argument of we have to do right by our users regardless of the business interests, because at the end of the day, doing right by your users is in your business interests.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I guess, a better way to end. I think the joke about the data joy was probably and Alexa recording people having joyful things. Hey, Alexa turned on again. Hi, Alexa.
Hey, later on, tell Alexa, read me the lyrics to Bohemian Rhapsody.
Oh.
It's like spoken word poetry. It's great.
I don't know if I can.
Do it.
I don't know if I can do that, Dave. Folks, we're going to take a break and stop for just a moment, and we'll see you back here in about 60 seconds. The Drunken UX Podcast is brought to you by our friends at NewCloud. NewCloud is an industry-leading interactive map provider who has been building location-based solutions for organizations for a decade. Are you trying to find a simple solution to provide your users with an interactive map of your school, city, or business? Well, NewCloud's interactive map platform gives you the power to make and edit a custom interactive map in just minutes. They have a team of professional cartographers who specialize in map illustrations of many different styles and are ready to design an artistic rendering to fit your exact needs. One map serves all of your users' devices with responsive maps that are designed to scale and blend in seamlessly with your existing website. To request a demonstration or to view their portfolio, visit them online at newcloud.com/drunkenux. That's nucloud.com/drunkenux. Hey, everybody, thanks for sticking with us. We're going to round this out. Get out of your hair. Thanks for joining us this week for episode number 36. Hey, if you're in Missouri by chance at the end of the month, I'm going to be at the Web Accessibility Summit in Springfield, Missouri. I'm doing a talk on transcripts. Ironic, I know, because we're behind. Don't worry, we're going to catch up on that. I swear, I know we've said that a lot too. But trust me, we are in fact working on that. But I will be talking there, and we'll have a table set up and whatnot. And if you stop by, say hi, I might have some little stickers and swag to give away.
Yes.
Also, be sure to stay tuned. We have a killer episode coming up for episode 37.
We're
going to have Rachel Cherry on from WP Campus to talk with us about the Gutenberg accessibility audit. I cannot speak highly enough about Rachel. about WP Campus, about the work they've done for accessibility in Gutenberg. So be sure to stay tuned, because that is not going to be a missable episode. So we're excited about that.
One thing I wanted to announce, the RailsConf was last week from when we're recording this, and one of the core team people did a presentation involving Diaper Base, and the day after that, Diaper Base app hit number one on Ruby repositories on GitHub.
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah, I took a screenshot. I was so proud. My baby did it.
You know you've made it big, right? It's like making the front page of Imgur.
For real, for real.
Hey, everybody, if you want to find us, jump on Twitter or Facebook at /DrunkenUX or Instagram /DrunkenUXPodcast. We'd love to chat with you, hear what you think of the episodes or what you're enjoying. You can chat with us on Slack at drunkenux.com/Slack, and that will get you to our Slack channel. Connect with us. Say hi. One thing I always get a kick out of is when I see somebody follow us on Twitter, and then they follow my personal account immediately after that. That always makes me feel a little good, I think. So, everybody, stay tuned. Join us in 2 weeks for the Gutenberg Accessibility Audit Review. Otherwise, thanks for listening this week. Take care. Build great things. And the only other advice I have left to give is one single thing. It's small, but it's big in its impact. And that's to keep...
Do less better.
Do less better. Jive for life. And keep your personas close, but your users closer. Bye-bye. Later.